of $900 would have grown to $91,865.74. Yeah, you read that right. $91,865.74. Now ask yourself again, would you rather have 91K or watch television? That is the power of frugality, coupled with diligent investing to transform your net worth. When you turn your money over to someone else, a cable company, for example, you're not just giving up that dollar amount, you're giving up all of the potential gains that money could have for you. In other words, the opportunity cost. And that was an example using just one useless monthly bill totaling a measly $900 per year. Imagine what the total would be in 30 years if you eliminated haircuts, movies at the theater, manicures, new clothes, new furniture, takeout, new cars, lattes, and everything else that's a drain on your monthly expenses. The heart of extreme frugality is the knowledge that the compilation of seemingly piddly amounts of money yield tremendous dividends over time. It's not like Nate and I have been invested for 30 years yet. We were only 32 years old at the time. But we'd saved at such a high rate that we'd walked our way right out of the culture of more and right into financial independence. Nearly anyone with a decent job could do what we've done, yet very few do. Why? Because it takes short-term sacrifice, long-term planning, and a conviction that what we want out of life isn't sold in a store. I want to take a step back for a moment and acknowledge the privilege inherent to our situation. Although Nate and I didn't inherit money, and our parents didn't fund our adulthood or buy us a house, we're both profoundly privileged. We'd made some good financial decisions, sure, but we also got supremely lucky, and in many ways the game was rigged in our favor. We were raised by well-educated, financially and emotionally stable parents who taught us to read, made sure we went to school, and shepherded us through life. These parents helped us pay for college and gave us advice on how to write our first resumes and did practice job interviews with us. The deck was stacked in our favor before we were even born. Our financial advantages are the product of our socioeconomic status, our education levels, and most of all, the benefits we both had while growing up. I believe that people, Nate and me included, aren't successful simply because they've made a few good decisions. I never want to lose sight of the fact that privilege courses through our lives and that Nate and I would be nowhere without this lucky start. We were born in the right country at the right time to the right people, all beyond our control, yet all largely responsible for where we are today. There's a great deal of institutional privilege and straight-up luck that goes into the success Nate and I have enjoyed. Amid these sound financial decisions and ability to pay cash for used cars and math about cable TV and the fulfillment of our dreams, Nate and I were mired in the often baby-spit-up-covered, often sleep-deprived, often harried trenches of our 4 months of insanity. As if it weren't enough to parent a 3-month-old, buy cars, and rent out and pack up a home, Nate and I experienced a string of homeowner nightmares, all in our Cambridge house, that we've come to call Revenge of the Appliances. I wish this were hyperbolic, but it's pretty much not. First, one of the pipes in our Cambridge home froze and burst on a particularly frigid night, which we discovered after arriving home at 8 p.m. on a Sunday after a weekend in Vermont. Nate taught himself how to install PEX plumbing and replumbed our entire kitchen at 10 p.m. Next, our oven broke. Nate took it apart, replaced several pieces, put it back together, and it still didn't work. We called oven repair people who did the exact same thing, and it still didn't work. We bought a new oven. The closet door in our master bedroom came off of its rolling track, and we had to dismantle, repair, and reassemble it. Our main water valve wouldn't shut off all the way and had to be replaced, which necessitated turning the water off to our entire street one morning. We had to replace two upstairs ceilings that threatened to collapse. The downstairs bathtub required refinishing, a hole in the floor needed fixing, and the Subaru's windshield broke, which necessitated replacement. Also, something happened to our toilet. Nate did something to make it all better. Our freezer started dripping water into our fridge, which was DIYable after considerable time spent on diagnostics. I also interviewed property managers for our soon-to-be rental, as well as moving companies for our soon-to-occur move, and contractors for those two ceilings, which had to be demolished and installed afresh. and then needed crown molding to conceal the gap created between the old walls and the new ceilings. Not to mention the bottomless reams of paperwork and logistics surrounding moving. See me picking up free moving boxes from my buy-nothing group, becoming landlords. See me cleaning the house in preparation for it to be photographed and rented out. Two new cars. See me at the DMV getting licenses and registrations, and welcoming a new human to the universe. See me in line at City Hall buying copies of her birth certificate. I always like to think that I can do anything for a short period of time, and in retrospect, this seems like a hilarious rundown of mishaps. But at the time, I was exhausted and nearly burnt to a crisp. I was figuring out how to be a parent. Nate was still working at an office all day, every day. Stuff kept breaking in the house we were trying to rent out. We had another house 150 miles away that we drove up to check on every weekend, and I forgot to mention that I was also growing my online business. We'd decided long before finding our homestead that I wouldn't go back to my 9-to-5 job after my maternity leave ended. I'd been building Frugalwoods in addition to my day job for 2 years at that point, and writing freelance articles for other financial sites. That fall, we'd realized Frugalwoods was a thing, and an actual revenue-generating business. Next to birthing my child, I was birthing this passion project that let me espouse my beliefs about frugality and simple living. And it was working. People were reading it. Lots of people. But the thing about a baby and a business is that they both need to be fed. Fortunately, I could multitask these dual needs. I'd snuggle Stella on top of a pillow, a hand-me-down my breast friend, if you must know, and wedge her between my body and the kitchen table so that she could nurse while I worked on my laptop. It was an epitome of the third way that Nate and I were carving out. We didn't want to outsource our daughter's care, not to mention the fact that daycare in Cambridge costs more than our mortgage. But we also didn't want to give up doing work that was meaningful to us. I don't work because we need the money. Our frugality allowed me to quit that lifestyle before I turned 32. I work because I enjoy it, because it enriches me and brings deeper fulfillment to my days. May 2016 finally arrived. We had tenants and a signed lease for an amount of rent that was revenue-generating after expenses, and we were miraculously packed and ready to go a full 3 days before a moving truck, and my blessed in-laws showed up at our house to schlep me, Nate, one dog, one baby, a household full of mostly used material possessions, and two cars from urban to rural. 15. Our third way. It was July 4th, 2016, and I'd signed up to bring 3 watermelons and 2 pies. Nate was down for setting up tents and chicken hauling, despite uncertainty over what the latter entailed. The parade started at 10 a.m., so at 9:45 I drove Stella the 2 miles from our house to the town center. I entrusted the pies and watermelons to the ladies' auxiliary, who were assembling the chicken lunch in the kitchen of our town center building. As I walked across the sun-drenched street to the pastoral lawn of what serves as our town's library, children's activity center, store selling locally made goods, coffee shop, hostel, and home to such groups as the Civics Clatch, the Women's Wellness Circle, and the Historical Society, I waved to Nate, who was setting up tents with a few of our neighbors. I bought a shortcake from the library's Strawberry Shortcake fundraiser and settled in on the lawn with friends to watch the parade. Stella was soon swooped into the arms of one of our neighbors, and I chatted with another mom I'd recently met. With a siren blast from our volunteer fire department's truck, the parade was underway. All the kids in town led the parade riding bikes they'd decked that morning with ribbons, stickers, and balloons. There was also a contingent wearing what I assume were last year's very patriotic Halloween costumes, an Abe Lincoln, a Lady Liberty, and a dinosaur wearing an American flag hat. Our local state rep and his wife drove in their truck and waved. The parade was all of 5 minutes long, but the cheers were riotous. Afterward, the kids recollected the candy they'd thrown to the parade spectators, aka their parents and the other adults in town. Stella and I met up with Nate, who'd completed his tent setting up duty and was getting ready to chicken haul, which, as it turned out, meant toting chickens from the outdoor roaster inside to the kitchen for the luncheon. We'd lived in Vermont for barely 2 months, and we already knew more people and had a more gratifying community life than we'd ever had in the city. Back in Cambridge, and before that in D.C. and New York City, We'd been surrounded by people. Our neighbor's house in Cambridge was a mere 10 inches away from ours. The buses, the subways, and the sidewalks were glutted with humanity. But we hardly knew anyone. We had a set of friends we'd get together with periodically for dinner parties or game nights, but we didn't have a true community. Our Vermont town of 400 people, on the other hand, embodies that word. People here are self-sufficient, because you have to be to live this remotely. They chop their own wood, grow their own food, and raise their own livestock. But they're also interdependent. They know no one can do it all alone, so they lean on one another. Back in the city, I'd always say things to friends along the lines of, "You should stop by sometime," or, "Let me know if you need help with anything." But my words were empty, and people rarely took me up on my offer. The first time I said something along those lines to a neighbor here in Vermont, they were in my garden the next morning helping me dig out flower bulbs to donate to the town's plant, book, and bake sale fundraiser. I didn't know I was missing, lacking even, the warmth, the support, and the wisdom that a community offers until we moved to Vermont. The day after we moved in, as Nate and I scrambled to unpack, a woman appeared at our back door. After living in the often contentious close quarters of cities for years, my first thought was that we'd already done something to offend the neighbors and that she was here to complain and or inform us we were being sued. But this is not the city, and that was not the case. Rather, she'd heard we'd moved in and had stopped by to give us several jars of homemade jam and to ask if we needed anything. Dumbstruck, we invited our new neighbor inside and chatted for an hour. This stereotypically rural behavior repeated itself as neighbor after neighbor dropped by unannounced to offer us a homemade foodstuff, assistance, and a keen interest in shooting the breeze. After each of our new friends departed, Nate and I would turn to each other and say, "This is why we moved here. This is what we wanted." Connection, warmth, and community-minded spirit. I'm no longer surprised by the immense kindness of everyone I meet out here, but I'm touched every time. About 6 months after moving in, one of my neighbors asked if she could come over to watch our daughter. I initially thought she was offering her services as a babysitter, which sounded good, but she quickly clarified that she didn't want to be paid. Without putting it in so many words, she wanted to become Stella's adopted grandmother. Our neighbor doesn't have grandchildren of her own yet, and she adores children. Seeing that Nate and I didn't have any family living nearby, she intuited that we'd probably welcome the help, warmth, and ultimately the love that a grandparent provides. She now comes over one morning a week to watch Stella, and one evening a month to allow Nate and me to go out on a date. This is a remarkable gift to us new parents, which is made all the more special because she's not a blood relative, and she doesn't owe us this service. She doesn't have to love our daughter, but she does. I know that arrangements like this exist in cities, in suburbs, and everywhere else, but for me, this type of deep connection didn't happen before our Vermont life. Not many people live out here, so those that do tend to forge relationships that defy market forces and social norms. There's documented research in behavioral economics that people don't respond well to being paid for what they consider favors to friends, and I find that rings particularly true in our rural community. Not much money changes hands, but a great deal of work gets shared around, which is how Nate found himself helping to fix the well at the town community center one Tuesday, and how he finds himself serving on the boards of two different local nonprofit organizations, and why every gathering out here is a potluck, weddings included. Another unique and fulfilling aspect of our rural life that I appreciate is the intergenerational relationships that form. When I lived in cities, I found that I always gravitated toward people who were almost exactly my age. Outside of work colleagues, I don't think I had a single friend who didn't fall within a few years of my birth date. Here in Vermont, however, I have friends ranging in age from 9 to 90. I never realized how much I was missing out on in my social life by having such a narrow age bracket of friends. I recently went to a double birthday party for two of my friends from church who were turning 30 and 70. And it wasn't until we were singing happy birthday and watching their heads bow over their candles, one gray with wisdom, one red with youth, that I understood the power of cross-generational friendships. For starters, these people know a lot of stuff. Nate and I joke that he should establish a weekly meeting with our 60-year-old neighbor across the street because Nate ends up calling him every few days seeking his advice on some aspect of planting our vegetable garden, or what to do with ashes from our wood stove, or where to buy chainsaw parts. Learning from our older neighbors and enjoying the richness of their experiences is one of my favorite aspects of my new life. What I didn't understand before experiencing this level of all-encompassing, interdependent community is that our consumer culture has tried to do away with the essence of community. Coffee shops, restaurants, clothing stores, computer brands, and more have all co-opted our inherent human desire for community, for belonging, for a tribe. Our modern world has dismantled our previously tight-knit communities of family members and neighbors bound together by the necessities of remote agrarian life. It's now much more common to drive to work alone in our car every morning, work all day in front of a computer screen, return home after dark, spend a few hours with our immediate family, then repeat that pattern over and over again. That's what Nate and I did for years. There's no time to meet our neighbors, let alone help them spread mulch in their vegetable garden in exchange for tomatoes. We're taught we can pay for everything we need. Our very lives can be purchased, and by extension, we can buy the rights to a fragmented community of like-minded consumers. Our unifying activity as a culture is shopping, and the one thing we all are is consumers. Consumption has become our spiritual outlet, our means of building relationships, of identifying ourselves by the brands emblazoned on our clothes, cars, shoes, laptops, and it has supplanted our interpersonal dependencies. Here in rural Vermont, however, I found a group of people who consciously disavow mainstream culture. There are no malls or movie theaters in our town. Instead, there are monthly town-wide potlucks. Coffee hour, with homemade coffee and goodies, every Saturday morning at the library slash local shop slash community center. Contra dances on the weekends. Neighbors coming over to help with the maple syruping or the apple harvesting. Town festivals and celebrations. A free summer camp for kids. The knowledge that you can stop by a neighbor's house unannounced. The security that your kids are watched over by a wide net of people and that if they misbehave, you'll hear about it. And a sense that we do, in fact, need one another. Not everyone is best friends out here, but most people would help you out of a ditch in mud season without expecting anything in return. The culture harkens back to a Rockwellian Americana I'd assumed was dead. But it's not. It's just slightly altered since many of us out here make our living at least in part via the internet. Our first week on the homestead, I felt like I was still running the marathon of our previous 4 months. Since my in-laws generously came to help us move and were watching Stella, Nate and I blitzed through unpacking and had the whole house set up in 2 days. We stashed everything unnecessary in the basement because I'd decided that in this house, in this new practice of simple living, I wanted to unpack only the things we used on a daily basis. I didn't want throw pillows on our bed anymore because all they did was waste my time and clutter up our space. I started to apply the principles of minimalism that guided my spending to the physical objects in my home. As soon as the last box was unpacked, Nate and I ran, I actually remember us jogging, outside to tackle the weeds in our bed of asparagus, planted by a previous owner and growing despite the jungle trying to choke the tender green stalks. We carried on like this for several weeks, corybantically jumping from one project to the next, repairing culverts, digging trenches, chopping firewood, weeding garden beds. Exhausted and overwhelmed by the scope of outdoor work that all seemed to need our attention right away, Nate and I realized we had to stop. We'd been on this treadmill of doing in order to get here, and we needed to relish it. At a certain point, you have to stop striving and start living. You have to arrive. One warm June evening, after we put Stella to bed, I got out our Scrabble board, poured 2 glasses of wine, and went out on the back porch with Nate. As we played and chatted instead of working on the land, which we'd done every other night, we started to sink into gratitude, into a recognition of how incredibly fortunate we were to achieve this unusual dream at such a young age, and to have the rest of our lives to enjoy it. We weren't going to get it all done that first year. The vegetable gardens we'd dreamed of, the firewood we needed to chop, the chickens we hoped to raise, the hiking trails we wanted to build through our woods, the apple cider we wanted to make, The bridge over the outlet to our pond that needed repairing still does, come to think of it. It wasn't all going to happen. And that was okay. Living on 66 acres means signing up to never be bored, to never have a dearth of projects, to never need to pay for entertainment, all of which we wanted. We had to ease into the realization that this life and this homestead was one of opportunity and one of balance, not a sprint of getting things done. As we talked this over, our mindset shifted, and we started to live with abundant gratitude instead of desperation over what was still undone. We started a routine of taking a hike together as a family every day, a practice we continued year-round, even in the depths of winter with snowshoes on our boots and Stella pulled behind us in a sled. Being in our woods transforms me every single time. After all, it's why we came here in the first place. Without fail, I breathe more easily and am refreshed after time spent in nature. Joy is not a done to-do list. Rather, it's the ability to appreciate and savor the simplicity of each day's routine, to not feel that you need a vacation from your life, to know that you're living as close to your ideal as possible every single day. After coming to the realization that we were no longer beholden to the hectic modern mindset of ticking down lists, Nate and I created a new rhythm of life. I've come to think of it as our own personal third way. For starters, we never set an alarm clock. We're also not any one thing all the time. Homesteaders, people who work on the internet, parents. But we're an amalgamation of these facets of our lives. We wanted diversity in our days, and now we have it. There is no handbook for what we do, this life that encompasses so many different niches. So we get to experiment, fail, succeed, and experiment again. What I've learned is that there are many other options for how a life can operate beyond the narrow, pigeonholed ruts our culture tries to force each of us into. Your goal is likely not to move to a homestead in the woods of Vermont, although, hey, maybe it is. But what I've found is that most people want more out of life than simply slogging through it as a mindless consumer. Whatever your goal happens to be, managing your money wisely and taking charge of how you spend it is one of the first steps in allowing something new and different and wonderful to flourish in your life. Nate and I used our money in unconventional ways for years. Now, we applied those same lessons to how we used our time. Just as our consumer culture offers a full range of ways to spend our money, it also prescribes how we should use our time. We're supposed to go to college, get jobs, get married, buy a house, have kids, and enroll in the idea that we'll have to do this for the next 40 years or more. That we'll have to work to earn money to support a lifestyle we're expected to have, because that's what everyone else does. But it's not the only way. It is so easy to accidentally let other people dictate your life. It happens to most of us without our even realizing it. We get slotted into predetermined roles based on societal expectations, something I did for years, without considering how we'd spend our time and money if we had the freedom to choose. Nate and I also chart a third, non-traditional path in the way that we balance work and family. We both work, and we both stay home with our daughter every day and have no paid childcare providers. We've blurred the lines between the standard dichotomy of stay-at-home parent versus working parent. We are both. This unusual arrangement is now feasible for some families, given the internet, the ability to work remotely, and the unconventionality inherent to entrepreneurship and modern marriages/partnerships. But it requires ruthless prioritization of how you use your time and your money. Both must go only in service of what matters most to you. When our daughter goes down for a nap, no matter what else is happening that day, I sit down and write. I can be found writing with baby spit on my clothes and in my hair, with the washing machine singing its end-of-cycle song, and with dirty dishes stacked so high the faucet won't turn on. But that is my ruthless prioritization, and that is what allows me to be home with my daughter and my husband while pursuing a career I'm passionate about. Now, on a practical level, let me be clear. It's not possible for both parents to work full-time every day, but a balance does exist. It's unconventional, but then what in my life isn't? Nate and I choose to work for the intellectual fulfillment, not because we need the income, and I'm keenly aware of the privilege inherent to our situation. I'm also conscious that our frugality is elective as opposed to mandatory, and that Nate and I are fortunate beyond belief to be in this position. Our conviction that we're privileged is one of the motivators behind our decision to create a donor-advised fund through which we contribute annually to charities. We feel an imperative to give back financially, as well as through volunteer work in our community. While there are elements of our lifestyle that are purely choices of personal responsibility, the overarching trajectory we find ourselves on is heavily weighted by our upbringings, our educations, and our resulting earning power. Although we never made investment banker salaries, and in fact both worked for nonprofit/mission-based organizations, we made good money. And the more you earn, the more you can save, and the quicker you can reach financial independence. That's not to say that it can't be done on lower salaries or with fewer built-in privileges, merely that the road was easier for Nate and me. Despite this, I don't want you to feel discouraged if your circumstances are different from mine, because there are gains to be had anywhere along the spectrum of frugality. For some folks, paying down debt will provide that peace of mind. For others, it's having a lifetime of savings invested in the market. For others, it's the ability to pay cash for their children's higher education. In whatever way you define financial security and peace, frugality is a tool that will get you there faster. In addition to our balance between parenting and working, Nate and I both crave a balance between work that's cerebral, done between our fingertips and a keyboard, and work that's physical, done across wide swaths of our property. Achieving that synergy between physical and mental is perhaps my favorite aspect of life on our homestead. I write on my laptop, looking out the window at our apple orchard, until there are no more words. Then, depending on the season, I go outside and pull weeds from our vegetable garden, or pick blackberries from the tsunami of bushes that grows wild and unchecked on the perimeter of our woods. Or I take Stella on a snowshoe hike through folded layers of whipped cream snow. Nate, for his part, bangs away at ones and zeros, this apparently being what software engineers do, until he needs to move, and then I see him from the window pruning our apple trees or in the woods with his chainsaw bringing down a tree for firewood, splitting it by hand with a maul and stacking it in rows to dry for the winter. In the city, our lives were divorced from the natural world. It didn't matter if it was snowing or 95 degrees or if blackberries were ripe somewhere. We were in offices all day long, no matter what. Now we base our days around seasonality. Each month, each day even, blasts us with the minutiae of seasonal imperatives. The first few weeks of living here, we harvested rhubarb constantly, as it was in the height of its growing season, and I could not fathom what we'd do with so much rhubarb. But then, just as quickly, the plants turned inward and became dormant. Being a neophyte gardener, I thought they were dead. Their time was done. My first lesson in the impermanence of a season. Having an intimate relationship with the natural world is a liberation from the technology, the pressures, the conformity, and the consumer-driven lifestyle of our modern age. Out here, it's not about us. It's about the seasons, the weather, the woods. We're not in control, and I love it. This new iteration of life is still evolving for us and will be for some time, I imagine. Our family is young, our homesteading knowledge is nascent, and we see a languid unfurling of maturation awaiting us in every sense. The unknowns of this future thrill me. 16. Smoothing out the happiness curve. The idea is to cut the saplings as close to the ground as possible. Same goes for the brushy weeds and twiggy stems. I was wielding the clippers, Nate had the handsaw, and Stella was asleep in a hand-me-down ergo attached to my chest. We were chopping our way through the trail next to our house. In fact, the very same trail we hiked up when deciding to buy our property. Nate later took the chainsaw and removed the logs bisecting the path, making this our first official cleared hiking trail. It extends in a loop circumnavigating our land at its perimeter, starting and ending at our house. In the summer months, we put Stella in the carrier and take our clippers on each hike, beating back the incessant undergrowth, scheming to overtake our footpath. For winter hiking, we got a game sled, traditionally used by hunters to cart deer and other game from the woods, lined it with blankets, and nestled Stella inside. Sleds specially designed to tow kids are 4 times the price and not as durable for handling rough terrain. Nate and I strap on snowshoes, and Stella snoozes while we pull her through our snow-covered woods. We can hike any day of the year, right outside our front door, and most days we do. There's no longer a barrier to entry, and we don't have to drive for hours or plan ahead or take the day off work. The woods are simply there for us. It's true that Nate and I don't buy Christmas, birthday, or anniversary gifts for each other, but it's equally true that we don't need to. We've smoothed out the happiness curve of our lives. Rather than living for vacations or weekends, we've created a life that delivers ongoing happiness on a daily basis. Before embracing extreme frugality, our lives resembled a spiky graph with peaks denoting milestones. Our wedding, dinners out on Saturday nights, weekend getaways, followed inevitably by the lowest valleys. Those ever-present valleys represented our daily routine, the Monday through Friday sludge of cubicles and office politics. We'd offset those valleys by spending money, by treating ourselves, and while sure there were the euphoric highs of buying a new dress or having a sumptuous meal out, we spent most of our time at our baseline, down in the valleys. Through frugality, Nate and I elevated our baseline to a permanent state of contentment. We're not deliriously gleeful every day, but our graph trends upward and is mostly smooth. We still have occasional spikes, a vacation say, but on the whole, what we've done is create a daily routine that embodies the things we love. Nate and I used to work for the weekend, for our 2 days of escapism. Now we are orchestrating a life where every day is an honest deliverance of our passions. Rather than work jobs we don't enjoy in order to afford hits of consumerism to soothe the discontent we feel over working those jobs, we stepped out of that loop entirely. Our culture espouses a treat-yourself mentality that goads us to surrender to all the short-term goodies we can possibly conceive of. Lattes, Netflix, a new car. We deserve it, right? But I think the treat-yourself culture masks a deep-seated fear that we'll never realize our long-term dreams, so we'd better live it up in the present. This becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more we buy now, the less money we have to make actionable progress toward our dreams later. The instantly gratifying thrills that our consumer culture peddles, everything from snack delivery services to biting fish pedicures, are nothing more than road bump opiates. Short-term pleasures that only serve to derail our actual goals. And we don't apply this mentality just to tiny purchases. If we think we'll never save up enough for a down payment on a house, we might be more liable to rent a ritzy apartment and fritter away our would-be down payment savings. I'm astounded at how many ways there are to waste money, and at how many of them I've personally fallen victim to. Marketers diligently create needs we never knew we had, and many products advertised to us fill false needs. This type of spending skirts the question of what we really want out of life. It's the classic conundrum of foregoing delayed gratification played out day after day, purchase after purchase. The more we buy, and buy into this culture of more, the more we think we need. It's a vicious, endless cycle. While I'm pretty sure the phrase extreme frugality sounds like a penance, it's actually the exact opposite. It's a deliverance. Nate and I consider our lives to be luxurious. We live where we want, as we want, on our own terms, and we're not beholden to anyone else. If that's not luxury, I don't know what is. Sure, we don't have new cars, but the key is that we don't want new cars or need new cars. We view money as a tool to be spent on things we need and that we value highly. Money doesn't bring us happiness, but it has granted us the financial freedom to construct a life we love. It's also true that Nate and I are satisfied with less. We've discovered that the rarity of something's occurrence serves to enhance its enjoyment. Just like eating to excess or drinking to excess, spending to excess delivers no lasting fulfillment. Judiciously meting out the resource of money, on the other hand, allows us to relish the things we do buy. When Nate and I go out to dinner, an infrequent event, we savor each bite. We thoroughly enjoy ourselves and we appreciate the uniqueness of the experience. Frugality turned us into people who feel profound gratitude for everything we have, as opposed to the people we used to be, constantly scraping and grasping for more. We've also simplified nearly every aspect of our lives. Instead of looking for expensive solutions, Nate and I ask ourselves, what can we stop doing, stop needing, and stop buying? I've stopped painting my nails, stopped wearing makeup, stopped fixing my hair, and just generally stopped doing stuff that ate up my time without delivering a commensurately valuable return on my investment. We try to identify the root of the issue and the problem we're trying to solve, as opposed to what a consumer mindset would tell us to buy. We live in a culture where people are lured into buying things they don't need to fill houses that are too large, and then feel compelled to move to ever larger houses and work ever longer hours in order to support a life that they're barely living, a life that they perhaps did not consciously choose, and that they perhaps do not even extract pleasure from. "But I don't want to live in the woods, and I like my job." I hear this from readers all the time, to which I respond, "It's not about wanting to move to the woods or quit your job. It's about liberating yourself from reliance on the salary that your job provides. Nate and I both choose to continue working to this day because we derive satisfaction from our work. The salient point is that we have the option to quit at any time, to walk away and pursue a different avenue in life. If we were instead wholly dependent on the money we're paid for this work, our options would be much more limited or non-existent. In addition to the freedom this provides, it's also a hedge against calamity and a way of self-insuring. If something terrible were to befall us, from a catastrophic illness to a car that won't start, money would not be an issue. There are a multitude of things in this life that we cannot predict or prevent or plan for, but financial stability is something that is largely within our control. I prefer to shore up my resources while I can in defense of the future unknowns. This doesn't make me a fatalist, but a pragmatic realist. Life is easier to cope with when you have enough money. Control what you can, and the rest of life becomes much less complicated to navigate. You very well might work your job for the next 40 years and love it every day, and I know plenty of people who have. However, no one has ever regretted having more money in retirement than they planned for. You can endow your grandchildren's higher education. You can start a private foundation and donate to charity. And you can travel the world year-round. It's also true that we live in mercurial times where jobs and pensions are not the bulwarks of security they once were. While none of us thinks we'll ever be laid off, it's no longer a certainty in most professions. Saving money now ensures you'll be able to take advantage of the opportunities and manage the hurdles that life will inevitably throw in your path. As Nate and I discovered when we unexpectedly found our homestead ahead of schedule, there's nothing more liberating than wanting to pursue an unusual dream and having the financial ability to do so. After nearly 4 years of dedicated extreme frugality, I've come to realize there are stages of frugal adherence. I've now arrived at what I imagine to be the final stage, profound contentment. I've freed myself from stressing out about my appearance, about my furniture, about my success. I've let go of the nagging external prompts to buy more and to, in the process, change who I am. I quite like who I am, and nothing I buy would ever change that. It was only after I stopped buying that I actually appreciated my own unique character, me on my own, divorced from the trappings of consumerism. My frugality evolves and changes with each new iteration of my life. Parenthood, homesteading, age. But it's the constant, the thread that runs through everything I do. It guides my decision-making by encouraging me to simplify, to be grateful, to never deny the abundance that surrounds me, and to recognize that there is very little I need in order to live a meaningful, fulfilled existence. Frugality has become about far more than saving money, although that's certainly a nice fringe benefit. Alongside my spirituality and my yoga practice, frugality is how I find peace in an uncertain world, and how I ensure I'm living a life I'll be proud of. I'm quite certain that no one on their deathbed has wished they worked longer hours, or owned a newer car, or bought more clothing. I like to imagine myself as an old woman reflecting back on a life well spent. Then I make sure I'm creating that life and populating those future memories. Frugality removed the myopia of my perfectionism, of my fears over what other people thought of me, and my drive to meet conventional metrics of success. Thanks to frugality, I have perspective. If Nate and I won the lottery tomorrow, We likely wouldn't change much about how we live. We'd have more money to give away to charity, and we might redo our kitchen countertops. They are a weird green plastic at present. But on the whole, we are content with our lives. I know that I will never be the richest or the smartest or the most beautiful or the kindest or the funniest person who has ever lived, and I am now at peace with that. I'm at peace with living as I see fit and as I see best and as I want. I am happy not to spend my money trying to achieve an ephemeral state of perfection because it'll never happen anyway. And that's not depressing to me. That's sheer liberation. Frugality mutes the noise of unnecessary desire and consumption and instead focuses us on our real priorities. Frugality opened my mind up to what I can do with my life, as opposed to what I can buy. This is Anne-Marie Gideon. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Meet the Frugalwoods, Achieving Financial Independence Through Simple Living by Elizabeth Willard Thames. This program was produced by B Audio Limited. Executive producer, Suzanne Mitchell. Text copyright 2018 by Elizabeth Willard Thames. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.